Good afternoon. This is Rish Outfield, and you are listening to the Rish Outcast. Over the last decade or so, I have been going to a writer's conference that happens in the winter, and it's been a tradition that I will talk to Big Anklevich about it. We've done several episodes where I talk about what I learned or what I felt, and I thought I would switch it up this time by not doing any episode at all. Good night, everybody. No, that's unfortunately you're not that blessed today. Instead, you are blessed with the presence of Marshall Latham.
Your Marshall wears Mandalorian armor.
Hello there.
Yeah, I've asked if he would come and just be my, what do you call that?
Sounding board?
Sounding board. You knew exactly. That was exactly what I was thinking of. I honestly was going to say ironing board. I'm not sure why. But I told him about the conference that I'd been going to. And it seems like a couple of years ago, I said, oh, you should come down here. That would be really cool. But did we just decide it was like 8 hours to drive, 7 hours to drive?
Yeah, it's a ways, but man, every time you talk about it, I'm always envious that you get to go to something like that. I did look in my area for something, and they don't have a writer. I mean, they have writer groups and things like that, but they don't have like a conference, a writer's conference. And they have a big fan con thing every year, but that's different than a writing conference. So,
yeah, a conference and a convention are not the same thing. And
exactly,
this is much, much more of an academic type thing. And my friend Jeff, who used to go to it all the time, his kids would actually get school credit if they chose to go to this conference.
Really? Wow.
For like their English class or stuff like that. And I remember, well, this year as well, but I remember sitting next to like teenagers or preteens at this thing and thinking, well, what is this kid doing here? And I know I told Big Anklevich about 5-6 years ago that I was standing in line to get into a room and there was a kid. And I let's say she was 14 that was standing next to me. She was one of those, I'm not going to say homeschooled kids, but one of those kids that talks to strangers because they haven't gone to public school and been bullied and mocked.
Right.
So she was just like, what are you here for? Are you a writer? And I said, well, as a matter of fact, I am. And she says, are you published? And I said, well, I sold a story to Weird Tales magazine. And she's like, I'm a published writer. And I was just like, oh, really? Yeah, what are you talking about? Like, in a magazine? And she's like, no, a novel. And there was just silence. And I was just like, I became W.C. Fields. And I wanted to say, get out of here, kid. You bother me. But I just remember just like how humbling, if that's the best word, that was to have a 13 or 14. And you know what? Let's be generous and say she was 15-year-old girl telling me how much better she was than me. But
it could have been self-published too, so you never know.
Well, I don't remember her saying that it was self-published. I think I remember her saying where you could get the book or something like that. But the difference this year between all the other years was, usually I will go to this thing and I will feel bad, because I'm surrounded by people that are way, way more successful than I am. And that's still true about the success, but I didn't feel so bad this year. And now, there wasn't a conference last year because of the pandemic, but the difference between this time and the last time I went was that 2 years of writing every single day. And one of the panels that I went to, they said, show of hands, how many of you in this room are working on a novel right now? And let's say 75% of the hands went up. And they said, okay, show of hands, how many of you in this room have completed a novel? And 5 or 6 hands went up. And suddenly I was just like, oh, wow. I'm not that kid that wishes that he were a writer anymore. I guess I am a writer. And there were other panels where I did feel bad. And a lot of the stuff that I hear at these conferences are repetitive, are things that I've already heard, are things that I already know. But sometimes it's good to hear something you already knew. It's good to be reminded of something. It's good when somebody tells a story and you're like, oh, I remember this story. And you hear it again rather than everything being new.
Yeah.
But every year for the past decade that I have gone to this conference, there has been somebody who says that I have a full-time job, or I have kids, or I have a full-time job and kids, so I have to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and write because it's before the kids are awake. That's how dedicated I am to my craft. Every year I hear that, and every year I feel bad because I'm not willing to do that. And this was the first year ever that I heard another panelist say, now, wait, that's not going to work for everybody. If I get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, I am the living dead. I wouldn't be creative. I wouldn't be able to put pen to paper. I wouldn't be able to speak. I am a night person. I would be much better to write from 11 to 1 at night. So those of you out here in the audience that can't get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, know yourself and do not beat yourself up if you can't do that. Show your dedication in a different way. And it was like this wave of, oh my gosh, relief that poured over me because I felt terrible every time. And it's not always the same guy that gets up at 5 o'clock, but there's always some guy that does.
Yeah, because I don't think I could do that either, get up that early and just write. I could get up that early, and I do get up that early sometimes, but I wouldn't be able to sit and write during that time. I would have to do that later after all the things that I'm supposed to do that day are somewhat done and settle in for the night or whatever.
Well, something that you've done over the last, I don't know if it's been 6 months, maybe it's been a year, is you will post pictures of the sunrise.
Yeah.
And that leads me to believe that you are up when the sun comes up. Because if not, you know, you're awfully tricky getting pictures of the sunrise. And my assumption is that you're headed to work when the sun is coming up.
Typically, yeah.
But so what time do you have to wake up to go to work?
On a typical day, I get up between either 6 or 6:30 in the morning. But if I have to get there early, you know, I may get up at 5 or 5:30 depending on what has to go on that day.
Well, do you have to get up at 6 or 6:30 tomorrow? Because it's already 10:30 p.m.
I might take it easy tomorrow. Get up at 7 or
something. I tend to be long-winded, and I worry. I should have warned. Maybe I did warn you that these tend to be really long. And what I was going to do was just go through my notes. I was highlighting passages, and I was just going to read these little bits. And then I realized, okay, that's like a two-hour conversation, and it's not even a conversation because it's just me talking and you patiently listening. Because it's a 3-day conference. It starts at 9 a.m and goes until 9 p.m
Okay. Yeah, that's late.
And that's an unbelievable number of panels to go to. Let me just read you the list of panels that I went to.
Okay,
so Thursday I went to the following panels. Plot, which to choose and use. What is a beat? More than the horror, relationships in the horror genre. Dealing with rejection. The keynote speech. The best fantasy and science fiction scenes so far. Selecting your character's arc. Conscious editing. It was 40 years ago today, ... The master painter, Michael Whelan, and failure management. That was Thursday. In fact, I'm not even going to read the list for Friday and Saturday, because after a certain point, it started to be too much. And I started to zone out during the panels, and I would look at my notes, and it would just be like doodles. Or it would be filled with like spelling errors. that shouldn't be spelling errors. Like, you know, I speak English. I write it every single day, and I'm spelling words I know how to spell right. And I think it's just that the brain fills up.
Yeah, you reach a saturation point where it's like, man, I can't take any more in.
Right, and that's something that I've got to figure out how to deal with. On Friday, the second day, I made it until 6 o'clock, and then I just couldn't stand it anymore, and I went to the library, and I wrote, and I felt like that was a better way, a better use of my time, because my brain just wasn't, what would you call it, processing what people were saying. Like, there was a panel about dialogue on Friday, that same day, and one of the women on the panel had that way of talking, and there's a name for it. You may know what the name for it is, but it's where everything that they say sounds like a question. And I'm here to be talking about dialogue. They go up at the end of every one of their sentences, so it sounds like a question, but it's a statement. And after hearing her go on about this, I started to not understand what she was saying. I thought, well, what the hell is going on? She started talking about dialogue tags. And you know what a dialogue tag is, right?
Yeah. He said, she said.
It's funny you should say that, because the guy on the panel, his name was Todd, started talking about that. He was saying that the dialogue tags are invisible, that your reader doesn't even pick up on them. So if you're worried about using the same words over and over and over again, said and asked are not part of that. And the character name, like Marjorie said, is not part of that. Do not say, oh, I've said too many times.
Yeah.
And the girl said, no, that's not what dialogue tags are. And he said, what? Oh, okay, what are dialogue tags? And she explained, and I still didn't get it. I didn't understand what she was saying. She explained what dialogue tags were. And I think there were four people on the panel. And one of the other people said, so what is a he said, she asked, if not a dialogue tag? And she said, those are dialogue tags, but that's not everything that a dialogue tag is. And she explained a third time. And I realized that she was saying that everything that is not dialogue is a tag. So like all of the action, all of the emotions and the beats and the plot in her mind was a tag. Huh. Like in screenwriting, there's this French term called mise-en-scène. And essentially it means anything that is not dialogue. Like interior, house, night. Michael crosses the room. He picks up the phone. Michael, hello. All of that was mise-en-scène except for hello. And I think that's what she meant by tags. But after that panel, I was like, I got to take a break. I can't listen to this anymore. And so that is interesting. And I think in the past, there has been a point at every one of these conventions where I have felt like I would have been better off going somewhere and writing. And 2 years ago when I was doing that crazy writing every single day. Like February of 2020 was the most writing I've ever done in my whole life. Yeah, I brought my laptop to each one of these panels. And at one point I just got up and I went out in the hall and was just writing because, you know, I had to get my words and all that. And it felt like a better use of my time.
Right.
You'll hear the same things over and over again. And one of the things... Oh, this is a good question. Do you know what my number one rule is of writing? Because I say it all the time.
Oh, my. Let's see. I don't. I can't think of any.
Okay, well, I've probably heard it, though. I know you've heard it because I say it over and over and over again. And it is read your writing out loud.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
I say that all the time. And it was interesting because I'd hear these people on the panels and three different times somebody said, read your work out loud. And I was like, oh, cool. I'm going to write that down. And so it's not just me. It's something that other people feel strongly about too. And that's...
Yeah, it's very helpful.
Well, it's helpful because it puts a distance between you and the writing, because my guess is that you use a different part of your brain as an editor than you do as a creator, as a writer. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Like, if you're checking for typos or problems with the sentences or, you know, character motivation or whatever, you look at it differently than when you're just weaving a story. And reading something out loud helps you take a step back. And does that sound natural? Does that sentence flow? Is there a better way that I could phrase that? Oh, does this have too many syllables in this? Or, oh, hey, did I use the wrong word here when I really meant, you know, something like that?
Yeah, it usually makes me break up my sentences more. Instead of having a long, complicated sentence, just break it up so it's more simple to understand and read, flows better.
One of the people, after they said read your work out loud, said, if you have Word, you can tell Word to read your document to you. Is that something that you have on your... Do you have the capability of just telling your computer to read it to you?
Not just automatically like that. I've you know, been able to copy and paste text into a utility that'll do that.
Okay. Have you found that that is helpful? Or is it better to just read it yourself?
I think it's better just to read it yourself, because then you catch it when you can't read it out loud, then you realize that something's wrong. Where at least the text readers that I've used, the timing is off and they don't always read the words quite correctly. So you spend a lot of time filtering what the computer is trying to interpret rather than getting the feel of what's going on in the piece.
Well, sometimes you will have a lady on your show that will say, Marshall, I am here from the future to tell you about your health. And she sounds pretty realistic to me. Is that a program, or is that the exact same thing?
That is, yeah. So I'll type it out and then I'll put it in that utility, and then it'll read it out for me. But I sometimes have to edit that so that it sounds good in audio. And then I have to end up putting like extra commas or, you know, different things so that it pauses correctly and stuff like that. Or sometimes she'll read the sentence and then say dot and then go on. So she reads the period as a dot. So it's not perfect, but maybe there's better ones out there. So,
well, did you pick the accent?
Yeah, there's, you can do male, female, and then they have different nationalities. But it's somewhat limited, but I typically go for the British woman.
But she's a character, and you've had her on so many times.
Yeah.
And I think the very first time that you had her, I thought, who is that? That's really cool, you know, that he knows somebody with that accent.
Well, good. The theater of the mind worked. So you talked about all the different panels and getting worn out and stuff. So, like, do you feel that you need to fill up your day with as many panels and presentations as you can to get your money's worth? Or do you feel like I just want to go to the things that I think are interesting?
The first one, like when I would go to San Diego Comic-Con, it's understood that because that's become so crowded, you won't be able to go to all the panels that you want to go to.
Right.
And so I would usually just like look and say, okay, this one and this one are the two that I most want to go to. And so I'm willing to stand in line for 90 minutes or whatever, so I can go to, you know, X, whatever that panel is. This is the opposite of that. With one exception, I was able to go to every single panel that I wanted to. And so there's just burnout. And because I paid money to be there, I try to maximize my dollar, you know, to look on the calendar and pick a panel every single hour, and then pick one hour where I'll go to lunch. And it's usually just like, okay, what can I skip? And that, but another thing that I do, and I probably should do this more, but each day I will pick a panel that looks like it will just be fun, where there won't be like any instruction. It's just like fandom or something like that.
And right.
On Friday, the panel that I chose to do was that they were having a live RPG game. They were doing a role-playing game with a bunch of podcasters that do an RPG podcast, and they were going to do the game live. But what I didn't realize was that it was a two-hour panel.
Oh.
And it was way, way, way too long. I could see that the Dungeon Master had like streamlined it and he had prepared everything. And he, you know, he'd say, okay, roll. And okay, you succeed, you fail kind of thing. And he had given them characters and arcs and he had interesting things for each character to do. But it was still just too long. And I've never played Dungeons & Dragons or any of that stuff growing up. And so I didn't realize that being a bystander is not fun. I thought that it would be just, you know, it would be like the Dungeons & Dragons episode of Community is what I thought it would be like. But what it was frustrating. It was like watching your kids watch somebody play a video game on YouTube.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And that's something that bothers you and it bothers me and it bothers Big Anklevich. It's not from our generation. We don't get that. To me, it's a waste of time. I would rather my kid play a video game, if you can believe that, than watch some a-hole shout at a webcam while he's playing a video game. But that's what it was like for the RPG. And if it had only been an hour and he had had to like cut out a lot of the stuff and just rush through, I think it would have been okay. But I was just exhausted by the end of the 2 hours.
But you stuck through it, huh?
I did. And there was a panel at 4 o'clock that was right in the middle called Recharging Your Creative Battery that I had planned on going to, but I was stuck at the role-playing game. And so I didn't go to that one, but there are so many panels that are like similar that I ended up going to another panel that was almost exactly like Recharging Your Creative battery. There were a bunch of very, very, very specific writing panels. There was one for writing protagonists, writing antagonists, writing character relationships, writing your world building, writing the environment. And they were just so specific that after I went to the protagonist one, I was just like, oh gosh, maybe I'll go to the bad guy one, but I don't know that I can go to any more because it was just too focused. And the brain fills up really fast. And I started doing things to entertain myself, like the doodling thing that I would do. And I looked around and there was a girl next to me in one of the panels. And I started looking at her notes that she was taking. And she would write one word. Let me see if I can find this in the thing. Because it was bizarre to me. So this was a copy editing panel that I went to. And my note wrote, the first 50 pages of a manuscript is where most writers make their mistakes. And I looked at the girl next to me and she wrote 50 pages. And I wondered, when you look at this, is that going to make sense to you? Is 50 pages going to mean something to you?
I've done that before where I've taken, you know, really cryptic notes thinking that I'll remember, but I don't. When later on, when I go back and read it, I'm like, I'm not sure what I was writing here or what it pertains to.
Maybe you never look at your notes again. I'm not sure how that works with this. There were so many like really interesting things that people said or things that were funny, things that I jotted down. But I don't know if I'll ever look at these notes again. I was looking at them to talk to you.
Right.
There was a panel that I went to called The Art of Failure. And it was something that I enjoyed going to. And it was something that I needed to hear. They were talking about, you know, people are so afraid of rejection. And that's because human beings are a social animal and that we have learned to depend on each other in a society to survive, to get to where we are. And so to get rejected in any way feels like dying. Because 10,000 years ago, if we had been rejected, we would not have survived.
Huh.
You're not part of the tribe or whatever. And I was just like, gosh, I wonder if that's true. But it does feel like dying to be rejected. Interesting. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They were talking in that same panel, they were talking about that one thing that you have to do in a novel is torture your characters, is put them through all sorts of difficulties and challenges, and obstacles come up in front of them because there's a triumph down the road, and it makes the audience care, and it makes the audience feel all the more pleased, happy, joyful when they reach that triumph. And they said, life is that same way for us. It's all of your failures and all of your setbacks and all of your disappointments that make life worth living, that make the success sweet. And I, again, I wondered if that was true. And something that you had been struggling with lately is that you keep setting all of these lofty goals for yourself.
Right.
And then I get the impression that you really beat yourself up when you don't achieve those goals. And in that same failure panel, they were talking about goals. And they said, well, why don't you set small goals that are actually achievable so that you can feel these small wins? Take the win where you can get it, is what they said. For example, hey, I got out of bed and wrote today. Hey, I'm going to take that win. At the same time, one of the guys on the panel said that he had set a goal. Oh, geez, take a breath, man. Of 1,000,000 words in 2022. He's going to write 1,000,000 words. And I just thought, why are you even here? That doesn't help me. That's like listening to Wilt Chamberlain go down the list of like his romantic conquests. And it's like, you know what? After 1,000, that ceases to be something that I can get my head around, Mr. Chamberlain. Yeah. I just, you know, I'm not.
Yeah, I guess what's his typical output per day if he's going to get 1,000,000?
Well, I don't want to do the math on that. But it's got to be like crazy number of like thousands of words each day, right?
Yeah.
Million.
So, I'm assuming there's also like book signings and readings and stuff like that going on with more acclaimed authors or successful authors, or is that not part of the conference?
They do a signing at the end of the night on Friday from like 7 to 9. And most of the people on the panels will plug that and say, you know, I'm going to be at the book signing if you want to get my books kind of thing. And something that we didn't talk about is a particular writer who is often at these conferences. And there was a panel that I went to, and it let out, and I was sitting very close to the door, so I was the first person to reach the door, and I tried to open the door and it wouldn't open. And I thought, wait, what the heck is going on? You know, it's like it's a movie where it's like they've barred the doors. It's a trap. But what it was there were so many people pressed up against the doors waiting for the next panel to start that the door wouldn't open when I pushed on it. And so I knocked on the door and then I pushed again. And this time the people got out of the way and I saw a bunch of teenagers standing there with Brandon Sanderson books in their hands. And I didn't have to ask. I knew what the next panel was. And every one of his panels were impossible to get into. You had to skip the panel before and get in line so that you could go to it. And every time one of his panels let out, there would be two lines. A line of people leaving the room and a line of people with books lining up to get Brandon Sanderson to sign their books.
Wow.
It's interesting to have seen the rise of his fame just in the past 5 or 6 years. You know, there are other writers who are successful that are full-time writers that were at the con, and nobody treated them like rock stars or anything like that. You know what I mean? They were just people. And I wonder about that. It's like, you know, if you're doing all right, do you look at him and you measure your success against his and feel bad? Or do you feel good that I can stand at a urinal and somebody's not going to ask if I will sign a book at the same time?
Yeah, that would be a different dimension to be in, to get that kind of attention. I wonder if he feels more pressure in producing his books because of that, or if he takes it in stride, or I don't know.
Well, how big a deal is he? Like, nationally or in the world, is he that successful? Like, is he the number one fantasy author in the world?
Well, listening to my son, who's a fan and just read pretty much all of his books, I mean, yeah, as far as fantasy books goes, you know, he's kind of on the top of the list. Like, when I was a kid, it was Margaret Wise and Tracy Hickman, at least for me, with the Dragonlance. But I know there was a lot of other people that liked those books. And, you know, they were kind of regarded as the fantasy authors. But you also had, like, R.A. Salvatore and a couple of guys like that. But I would think that Brandon Sanderson is probably in that same league, at least with my son's generation, anyway.
Well, I usually gauge success, and this is narrow-minded, I'll be the first to admit it, but I gauge success in a writer based on how many of their projects are made into films and TV shows.
Mm.
Like, J.K. Rowling is the biggest writer in fantasy, in my mind. It seems like she could buy and sell a dozen Brandon Sandersons. And by that same token, George R.R. Martin has to be a much bigger deal.
Certainly, certainly, yeah.
Than Sanderson. Why has he not sold his books and have, you know, a Netflix series or an Amazon series?
That's a good question, yeah. I'm not sure.
You've never read any of his stuff?
I haven't. I've thought about it, but I haven't sat down and read any of it.
Well, I mean, it's an ongoing joke on my show that he is Superman and I am Lex Luthor. And it amuses me because to everybody who has ever read a comic book, Luthor is a bad guy and Superman is a good guy. But yet I relate to Luthor rather than to Superman, especially when Brandon Sanderson is concerned.
Right.
And people will talk about what a nice guy Sanderson is. And that only makes me like him less.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you, too, is, I mean, is he a humble guy or is he kind of smarmy, or, you know, how does he come off in public or when he's given a presentation? Is he humble and approachable and friendly?
Yeah, he's absolutely humble and approachable. And I've never heard him complain about the adulation that he gets at these conferences. The one in 2020, he said, "Hey, folks, I know there's a lot of people that want me to sign their books, and I'd be happy to do it, but there's another panel about to start. Let's all go out in the hall." And I don't know that Bruce Willis would do that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The panels that I've gone to where he has spoken about his career and his success, it sounds like Superman talking about, you know what, there were a lot of firemen and police officers that saved just as many lives as I did at that disaster site. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He's so soft-spoken about, like, his own work. But the only thing that he will brag about is how much work he does. You know what I mean? Where he's just like, I am a writer, and that's what I do all the time. And when I was a starving artist, I got a job as a receptionist at a hotel for the night shift because I knew that I could write and I would be standing up the whole time. And so I taught myself to write standing up. And, you know, I'd do my job when a customer would show up, but I specifically told them I wanted to work nights because I knew there would be way, way fewer distractions. And I could write 5, 6, 7, 8 hours at a stretch. And I've never stopped writing that many hours a day. And when I hear things like that, I'm just like, well, I'm not willing to do that. It's like the 5 o'clock in the morning thing.
Right.
I'm not willing to do that. And so I can't begrudge this guy his success because he's working a heck of a lot harder than I am. You know, there are people that don't seem to have earned their success. And, you know, I tend not to respect those as much. But, yeah, this guy somehow manages to write a 700 or 800 page book, not just every year, but twice a year.
Yeah.
It's mind-boggling. And a few years ago, when I put on this bald cap and purple shirt, or purple, what is it that Luthor wears in the comics? Is it a jumpsuit or something?
Oh.
I was telling Big that, you know, I had read I think it was the third Sanderson book that I had read. And the first one that I read was The Way of Kings, which everybody said is, oh my gosh, this is the best fantasy novel you'll ever read. And it was just so, so long. And I felt like unnecessarily long. Like there would be these, gosh, what do you call them? Where it's in between chapters, where it would go off on a different tangent.
Interludes?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what they'd call it. Interlude one, interlude two. And that I'm not smart enough, I guess, to understand what the interludes were for. One of the panels they were talking about, and something that editors hate. I don't know if you've heard this before, but editors hate prologues. They always tell you, do you need your prologue? There was an editor a few years ago that worked for Tor, I think. And it's like, anytime somebody sends me a manuscript for a fantasy novel and it has a prologue, I reject it.
Wow.
And I was like, what? Really? And at this panel and this thing, they said, everybody will tell you not to write a prologue in your fantasy novel that like tells what happened to make the world the way that it is. You know, it's like you need to convey that information through the action of the story.
Right.
And then you look at Brandon Sanderson and he has 3 or 4 prologues in the same book and somehow it works. But I was just reminded of that, of reading Way of Kings and just being like, oh my gosh, why is this book 800 pages? Couldn't it have been 500 or 600? And that was the book of his that I enjoyed the most. And then I went on and I read the one that I complained. You still bring up how I complained about it, where it was just, I really, really didn't like the language of the book. And then I read Alcatraz and the Evil Librarians. Does that sound familiar?
I think I've heard that title. Yeah, something like that.
And I said to Big Anklevich, I was like, look, I've read 3 of his books and I enjoyed one of them and I just absolutely hated the other 2. Is it okay for me to just say I'm not ever going to read this guy again? And Big says, well, I don't know. You're missing out. You're going to keep yourself from enjoying these really, really, really good books. And it made me feel bad. But later I thought, you know what? There are 100 books written every single year that I would love that I'm never going to get to because I'm not going to live to be 120 years old. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so I decided that I wouldn't read his stuff anymore and that I'd really lean into the rivalry between us. But it was interesting. And I kept track of how many times his name was spoken in panels.
Right.
And it was 12 times somebody brought him up. Like that example I just used where Brandon Sanderson has 3 prologues in his book and somehow he makes it work.
So they give you some guideline or some rule and then they said, unless you're Brandon Sanderson, maybe I'll have to read one just to give my 2 cents in there.
Well, yeah, I think you should. But my fear is that you're going to be like, you know, of all the people in the Justice League, Superman is the most humble. He is the most down to earth. And he's the one that loves our planet the most. And I just, it's like, oh, there seems to be a grinding sound coming through right now. What is that? Oh, that's your teeth.
But I'm sure there's much more we can talk about than Brandon Sanderson.
Yeah, of course there are. And I just, I think that you would enjoy coming to some of these panels. for mostly the same reason that I do, and that is that you surround yourself with creative people.
Yeah.
And it feels like a community. It feels like you're not alone. It feels like there are other people out there like me. And something, shoot, I wasn't going to say this, so maybe this should be an outtake, but it was something that I that really shocked me at one of the panels. And it might have been the same panel that said, you know, it show of hands, how many of you have completed a novel? But they said, in this room, how many of you are writers? And I think it was like 90 to 95% of the hands that were raised. And the other people would be artists.
Oh, okay.
Maybe musicians. Maybe somebody that wanted to be an editor. I think, you know, sometimes there are actors that come to these things. And then the panelist said, show of hands, how many of you in this room are somewhere on the autistic spectrum? And about 80% of the hands came up. And I was just horrified because my first thought was, does that mean that only people with autism become writers?
I wonder. Is Stephen King autistic and we just never knew about it? He was never diagnosed?
Well, the people will talk a little bit about how being a writer is kind of like being schizophrenic or mentally ill. You know, having conversations with people that aren't there, or believing that people that don't actually exist and things like that. But that really surprised me that there were so many hands, because if I had been a wagering person and you had said, hey, how many people in this room would self-diagnose as autistic? I would have said, well, you know, 3 to 5 in the room, maybe 10%. And, you know, it ended up being 90% or 80% of the people in the room.
Yeah.
And that shocked me. But it also made me wonder how many of you are somewhere on the autism spectrum. It's sort of just a catch-all of, you know, how many of you in this room feel like you're not like everybody else, or you're not just a normal person, you know, that you're unusual or special, or, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's why I was hesitant to share this bit, because everybody has a support animal now. It's like, yeah, this is Andrew. He's my comfort tarantula.
I need him on this trip. Yeah. That's very interesting. Yeah.
I tend to see the same faces as the panelists over and over again. And there's a guy named Brandon Mull. He's a YA fantasy writer. Is this a name that you know?
I don't. Brandon Mull. No, that doesn't sound familiar.
Yeah, he's got a series called Fable Haven. And
oh, I've heard that. Yeah, I haven't read it, but I've heard of it.
Anyway, I've seen him age before my eyes. He looks like a middle-aged guy now, and that has been vexing, is to see the time pass with just some of these people. And there was a lady, and she was on 3 of the panels that I went to over the weekend. And she would introduce herself each time by saying, I write clean YA.
Okay.
And the second time that she said it, I was just like, well, that's funny that she said that before. And then the third time that she said it, I thought, okay, well, why is she saying that? Because isn't dirty YA the exception to the rule?
That's a good, yeah, I don't know. You think of Hunger Games, that was fairly clean.
Do you read a lot of YA?
I don't. That's probably the biggest one that I've read the entire series of.
Well, it's interesting that was a, you know, a huge hit series, and they had to sanitize that to make PG-13 movies about it.
With the death and the violence, yeah.
That sort of thing has always made me wonder, well, what is the definition of YA? I mean, what makes something YA versus just an adult novel that happens to have teenage protagonists in it? And I've never had anybody explain that to me. It's like obscenity, how they used to say, I don't know how to define it, but I know it when I see it. Mm. That's how they used to say that was the definition of obscenity. I think YA is the same way. Because there'd be people that would argue about what is a YA novel and which audience should it be advertised toward, marketed toward, and whether if it's marketed toward teenagers or preteens, then it's YA. But now there are all these terms, and I remember the first time I heard the term middle grade.
Oh, yeah.
She writes middle grade novels. I was just like, middle of what? Like middle aged? Like, no, middle grade. It's like before YA, but after juvenile. And I was like, whoa, what's juvenile?
Yeah.
Because juvenile growing up was a criticism.
Yeah.
Oh, that movie was super, super juvenile. That meant it was crude. It meant it played to the lowest common denominator. It was not sophisticated.
Yeah, the first time I heard that term middle grade is when Greg Van Eekhout, who's an author that I've kind of followed a little bit, and he came out with a middle grade novel, and it was Kid Versus Squid was the name of it. And yeah, it's for a younger audience, but it's above a children's book, but it's not quite YA. It's just kind of for that third to sixth grade kind of. So maybe that's what they're talking about. It's not your kindergarten, first grade, second grade novel, but older than that. But he's written like two or three of those now. I tried to get those for my kids when they were younger, so they'd enjoy it. But
did you find that it was difficult to get your kids to love reading? Like your son seems to really, really love it.
Yeah, he does.
Is he unusual?
Yeah, well, two of my kids like to read. Yeah, one son and one daughter like to read. My youngest son doesn't like to read at all. He will, like for school or whatever, if they have an assignment, he'll read it. But he'd rather listen to it than read it because it's faster, you know. So he doesn't enjoy the act of reading necessarily. He doesn't mind getting the story, but he's not patient with it, I guess. But yeah, my older son, he went to these, they probably have them in your area too, but when we were in Oregon, he did the Battle of the Books. Have you heard of those?
No, tell me what that is.
It's like you get a team of readers and everybody in the school district gets a list of books that are going to be part of the Battle of the Books. So the kids split up which books who's going to read, and then it's a competition where they go and they get quizzed, you know, questions about the books, this team against this team. And, you know, they raise their hands or whatever and have to give the right answer. And if they don't get the right answer, the other people can try to get that point. And it's really fun and it's very competitive. He did that for at least two years, maybe 3 years. And I went to one of those when he was competing and it was pretty intense. Those kids, man, they knew those books backward and forward.
Was it like a game show kind of thing, only, you know, not televised?
Yeah, it was. I mean, you could make a game show out of it. It was just, you know, trivia questions about this list of books that they were supposed to read. And it was pretty detailed, too. And the kids would know these answers. And so that definitely encouraged kids to read. I wished... they would have had something like that when I was a kid.
Yeah, I do too. That sounds really fun.
So that got him into books. But I think my daughter did that 1 year, but wasn't as serious about it. Her group of friends weren't as dedicated to it, but she had fun. So I guess, I don't know if you want to save this to the end or whatever, but what were your three most favorite panels that you attended? Or if you only have one or two, that's fine too.
The one that I liked the most was probably The Art of Failure. I think I talked to you about that.
Yeah.
I certainly took the most notes in that panel because that's where they said things like, you're not going to die. You know, rejection does not define you. Your successes don't have to define you either. Your work can define you. But don't pin all of your hopes and dreams on one acceptance or rejection. One of the ladies said, tell yourself, I'll get accepted after my 75th rejection letter. And that way, every rejection that you get is a stepping stone to that final acceptance. And maybe you'll get accepted before then. It was, you know, stuff like that where you need to hear, you need a cheerleader. You need somebody to say, keep going. You're doing well. I see you. I see what you're doing and keep going. Right here in my notes, getting through rejection is one of the main characteristics of a successful writer.
Mm.
You know, it's just something that you have to learn. And I have gone to panels before where they talk about how many times they had submitted a story before it sold. And it was just unbelievable numbers. It was just like, you know, I sent this short story to 46 publications before it got accepted.
Wow.
And you just think about that. And I think, well, just write another story. Heck, write 10 more stories. But that's just me. Everybody has a different philosophy and an idea. And maybe the person that has 3 stories that they've written and they send them to 40 different places is more successful than somebody who has 20 stories and sends each one to 2 places.
Yeah.
Oh, another thing that I wanted to mention, and it's apropos of nothing, but there was a writer and her name was Allie Cross. And she was talking about, she's been a writer for like 15 years and she has a couple of works published, but she's changing her name. And I was just like, wait, what? And she said, I'm going to have to come up with a pseudonym that I'm going to start publishing under. And she said it as though, well, it's self-evident why I would be doing this. And I thought, well, gosh, I don't know what's going on in this woman's life. But she seems to think that all of us know why she would change. And so at the end of the panel, there were questions. And it wasn't me that asked it. Somebody else had the same question. They raised their hand and said, Allie, why are you changing your name if you've already published books under Allie Cross? And she said, oh, James Patterson has a series of books that he just started publishing, and the heroine's name is Allie Cross, spelled exactly the same as my name. And so I have to change my name. She said she's Googling herself. And when that book came out in 2019... the first book, and the second one was in 2021. She used to have to go to page 3, page 4, page 5 before her name, she would even find herself, because it was all James Patterson, Allie Cross stuff. And I just thought, oh gosh, that sucks.
That does, man.
But I don't know. Yeah, I don't know what else you would do, but it just, yeah, I felt bad for her.
I thought you were going to say she decided to start writing all erotica or something like that.
Yeah, the pseudonym thing, I think we've talked about that before.
We have,
Of just, it's really interesting, the people that do pseudonyms, and multiple people were on their panel and they'd say, you know, my name's Jessica Reynolds, but I publish under J.E. Reynolds, or I publish under J. Stevenson. Even though my name is Reynolds. Then there would be people that say, yeah, well, I've got series of science fiction under this name. I've got horror under this name. I've got YA under this name, or children's books under this name. And we've talked about that before. I don't really understand why they feel the need to do that, because it seems like if somebody read a book that you wrote and they loved it, that you would want them to have as many chances to buy more of your work as they could. But I guess there are people that would hate to accidentally pick up a Western by you when they liked your fantasy novel, you know?
Yeah.
I'm not really sure. Abigail Hilton is a good example. Because she has started writing under a pseudonym. And it seems like her pseudonym is eclipsing her real name in popularity, but it's a picture of her on Amazon under both names. And then in her bio on both names, it refers to the other name.
Okay.
Just so you know, I guess it's to be expected. I'm not really sure. They had what do you call it? Like a presentation in memory of Dave Wolverton,
right,
who just died. They said, you know, Dave Wolverton / David Farland, because those are two different fan bases, even though it was the same person. And I never really understood, because fantasy and sci-fi don't seem that different to me.
Yeah. I mean, different backgrounds and setups and rules and stuff, but typically, if you like science fiction, you like fantasy also, and vice versa.
Yeah, when I will read about the pulp authors that had like 11 different pseudonyms, it seems to be because they were submitting multiple stories to the same magazine, and they wanted to trick the editors into publishing more than one of their stories in a single issue. Yeah. Is that's the guess that I had. And then there were people like James Tiptree Jr. or whatever, who was a woman, but she published under that name because there was a stigma against women writers. So I get that.
Right, that makes sense.
But yeah, that sort of thing is really interesting to me. There were people on the panel that would say, you know, this is my real name, but this is what I publish under. So if you want to friend me on Facebook, friend me under my writer name, you know, because the other name is for friends and family or something like that. And I was just like, huh, but why even tell us your real name then?
Yeah, if you're going to be anonymous, then stay anonymous kind of thing.
I feel like I've probably talked for a long time, but something that I've always wished that I had more of, that I see over and over again on these panels, and you've heard me say this before, is these writers have to be pitchmen for their own work. They have to be cheerleaders. They have to be their number one fans,
right,
and put their best foot forward and say, this is my book and this is what it's about. And you love it if you buy it, and it's well worth your time. That to me is really interesting, because you can hear the people give their log line, or what they used to call an elevator pitch. You know what I mean? It's where I have written a screenplay and I happen to be in an elevator with a movie producer. So in three sentences do I tell him what my movie is? There will be these people at the panels that will explain what their book series is all about in like two sentences, and they've got it down so fast, you know, they've said it 100 times.
Yeah.
And that's something that I wish I were better about. I'm always loath to tell people to go out and buy my stuff. Even, you know, like when I publish something, I tend not to even mention it on my podcast or whatever, but the podcast is where the people who are most apt to buy it are.
Right.
It's one of those lessons that I should have learned long ago, but it seems clear I'm never going to learn it. You said in one of your podcasts recently that your family had gotten you a subscription to Audible and you had these credits. You're looking for stuff to buy with it. And you said, you know, I hope that Rish puts out another anthology soon, because I'll buy that. But he hasn't said anything about it. And I was just like, this guy went out of his way to say, I'll buy it if he puts it out. And I haven't put it out.
But you're working on it.
Well, Gino sent me the cover art for it. And that's usually the last thing, the last piece of the puzzle, the only thing holding me back. And now that I've got the cover, it's just me holding me back. It's sad. I should definitely have raised my hand when they said, who is mentally ill in this room?
Well, I'm going to be in the same boat as you, because I made that as one of my goals.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about your goals for a minute. You have at least three, but it seems like it's more like five goals for the year of your writing. One of them is pants on the ground, right?
Yeah, I'd like to do a serial on my Patreon, you know, every quarter or something. I reveal another chapter of the story or whatever. That's what that's all about. I had written it back, or a version of it, but I never finished it. You know, it was like I did several parts of it, but I never got to the middle or the end. So I'd like to finish that up, but at least start it. I think I'll have a lot of fun with that if I start doing that.
Dude, my suggestion to you is to put out the first installment, because it lights a match under yourself, or lights a stick of dynamite or something like that, where once the first installment is out there, then maybe you start to feel the pressure of listeners wanting to know where the rest is, or you knowing that you put it out there is like, how do I live with myself if I've never finished this thing?
Right.
When I lived in LA, there was this writer's group that I would go to, and it was every other Wednesday. And when it was going to be my turn to read part of my screenplay, that's when I would suddenly sit down and start to write it. Yeah. Because I would hate for it to be my Wednesday and I haven't written anything. And the guys are like, whoa, well, come on, you left us hanging. And now it's your turn and you didn't write anything. And so it would be like 2 days before, the day before, I would pound out, you know, 6, 7, 8 pages as hard and fast as I could. And then I wouldn't write on it again until it was my turn again. And it just, maybe that will help you. It certainly helped me when it was my turn.
Yeah.
One of my goals for 2022 is that years ago, like 2013 or 2011, I started writing a serial, like you said, called Caller ID. And I talked about it and I said I was going to put it out on the podcast, and I never did. And so one of my goals is this year I'm going to put out the very first installment of that. And you've heard the premise before, but a kid gets a cell phone, and every year on the same day he gets a call on that cell phone from himself in the future to give him advice about life or whatever. And at some point when he's like old enough to drive a car, his adult self starts giving him missions of things to do, you know, things that happened in my past this year that you can fix, that you can make not happen. And so my idea was to write another one of these and put one out every single year on that week or the day that he gets the phone call. I thought it was a really cool idea, and I thought that people would enjoy catching up with this kid every year.
Yeah, waiting for what's going to happen this year.
And I looked at the, because I got a folder that for Caller ID on my laptop, and I looked at it like 2 days ago, and there are 3 different audio installments already edited, 3 years worth, just sitting there. And I've never put them out. And I just thought, that's disgusting. I thought I had at least the first one, but I didn't realize I had done 3 and I've not put them out. And so, yeah, that's one of my goals for this year is my birthday week. I'm going to put out that first one. And that way I'll be able to remember every year. Okay, make sure you put out a caller ID on your birthday.
Yeah, there you go. So how much do they talk about, or what is the mood about self-publishing? Do they encourage it or discourage it? Because even at the beginning of this, our conversation here, I said, well, maybe it's just self-published, so maybe it's not that big of a deal. But I would think that self-publishing is becoming more and more of a thing. But I think there's still that stigma or that prestige of, no, I got this published by a magazine. You know, I submitted it and it passed the test kind of thing, rather than just self-publishing.
Well, there has been a sea change about that. It used to be that self-publishing was seen as like a vanity press kind of thing.
Right.
Where you would pay somebody to put out your book because you weren't good enough for a real publisher to buy your book. But in the last few years, with the explosion of like the Kindle and people self-publishing on Amazon, and people like Andy Weir, right? Or,
oh yeah.
Gosh, what's her name? P.D. James. What's the 50 Shades of Grey chick?
Oh.
These people that self-published and then they made it, you know, that their books, you know, attracted so much attention that regular publishers were like, oh gosh, we want a piece of this. It's become so profitable for certain people that yeah, there are always panels about self-publishing now.
Okay.
But most of the people on the panels are people who have traditional contracts with Scholastic or Tor or a publisher. You know, they have an editor and they have release dates and all that stuff. And there are pros and cons to both. I mean, obviously, the biggest pro of having, you know, being with Scholastic is that a lot of the work is done for you. The cover art, you don't have to create a cover art and pay somebody to do it. But as far as like the self-publishing goes, they said you have to sell a lot. And so it's better to have a lot of books. And the one panel that I went to where they talked about it said, you know, once you have 50 books that your readers can buy, then you will make enough that that can be your job. I mean, unless, you know, one of these books explodes or whatever, and then you've made it. But the rule seems to be 50. And that seems crazy to me, who only manages to write like 2 books a year or 3 books a year and considers that a huge success. But there are these people that will write a book every 90 days, a book every other month. And if you're writing a book every other month, then 50 is, what, 7 years? Maybe, yeah. It's not. There are a lot of panels, and maybe you would go to those if you were here, about, you know, choosing your own cover art and being your own editor and things like that. And I did go to a couple of the editing panels. And something that they said is, even if, you know, you're going to submit your work to somebody to edit, you're going to pay somebody to edit it for you, you should still make sure that it has a beginning, a middle, and an end, and it has a coherent theme, and that, you know, the character names are straight and all that. And your editor will help refine that. Your editor will help narrow the focus and say, you know, I don't feel like this character contributes as much, or, you know, this chapter needs work. But you still need to do the lion's share. And that's something that I think is super applicable,
yeah,
to being a self-published guy. And you and I have something in common in that we were both editors, essentially, for a fiction magazine.
Yeah.
We both read through the submissions and picked the stuff that we liked that resonated with us. And that helped me, I think, see problems. And I don't know if it helped me correct the problems in my own work, but it certainly helped me be aware of what some of these problems are. And it showed me what I didn't like. And so maybe you and I have a leg up because we've had that experience.
Yeah, we've had that slush reading experience.
And it's made me really, really good at catching other people's typos, or this name changed to something else, or, you know, I don't know that this sentence, the person that you say said it, you know, that kind of stuff.
Okay. Yeah.
I think the vast majority of people were burned out by the end of the conference, because the last panel that I went to was at 6 p.m. on Saturday, and there were about 8 people in the panel. Then the next panel that I was going to go to was about collaboration with other writers. And when I went to it, they said, oh, yeah, we decided just to cancel all the last panels of the night.
Oh.
Have a good weekend. So I think, yeah, that something had happened where enough people were just like, okay, we're tired. We're not going to do the last panel. But I would have liked to have gone to a collaboration panel. That's something that I'm always fascinated about, when I hear how other people write together. And I know that there's a dozen different ways. You can have the two people hunched over the computer together. You can trade off. You can alternate chapters. When Biggin and I did our last collaboration, we alternated days. So he wrote today, and then I wrote. And then he wrote, and then I wrote. And it seems like, you know, there's a bunch of different ways to go about it. I would like to do more collaboration, but it seems like you kind of have to have somebody that's the driver.
Yeah.
In your experience, can you just split it 50-50?
I don't know. It seems like, even as similar as some people might be, everybody has a different style. So I think it would be, unless you had somebody that came in after and cleaned it all up to make it all sound the same, it seems like you'd have two different voices going on throughout the book, unless you each took a character. Like, I'm going to write from this character's point of view, and I'm going to write from this character's point of view, and then the chapters would go back and forth like that. I could see that working pretty well for a collaboration.
Yeah, that seems like a good a good way to go. I remember I went to a panel on the TV show Heroes at the end of the first season, and they had the writers, or they had like the creator, Tim Kring, I think was the guy, and then Jeff Loeb was there representing the writers, and he said that each writer wrote all of the scenes for a character. And then they just split them up through the season. And his characters was Claire Bennett and her father. And I was just like, oh, wow, that's the part I liked the most about Heroes. Interesting.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm not sure how you do that in a novel. I mean, if it's one of those fantasy novels where everybody is in a different part of the country and they're all having their own adventures, like, you know, like Game of Thrones kind of thing. I guess I could see you writing all of your character and me writing all. But what if it was like one guy writes the bad guy and one guy writes the good guy?
Well,
and then you bring them together at the end. What do you do?
Yeah, they need to have to come to an agreement or whatever.
I wonder how many friendships have ended over collaborating.
Yeah.
I was looking at James Patterson's bibliography. Because I was looking for the Ali Cross thing so that I could tell you that anecdote about the poor lady who has the same name as a protagonist in his books. And he's got all of these books that he wrote by himself. And then he's got a gargantuan list of books that he's written with someone else. And I still don't understand how that is possible.
Yeah.
Even if he just comes up with a paragraph and says, go write this book, and my name will be on it, and your name will be on it too. I don't even see how that could work.
Yeah, unless you had like an idea person and the person that actually wrote it, you know. Like.
And you know, maybe that's what he is. Because Patterson's output makes Sanderson look like George R. R. Martin's, I guess. Or no, what's his name? The Catcher in the Rye guy. J.D. Salinger, you know, or To Kill a Mockingbird lady.
Harper Lee.
Harper Lee, she wrote one book and that was it. And then they put out a book after she was dead. And
right.
Everybody wished that she had just written one book and that was it. Anyway, sorry. What was the last thing that you were going to talk about?
Are there any panels where they talk about writing comic books? Is that part of it or is it only the prose stuff?
There probably were. There are different emphases, whatever you would call it. Like there's a theater track.
Oh, I see.
And there's a music track. And mostly I went on to the writer track things. But there are also artist tracks where they talked about painting and they talked about graphic novels and they talked about computer graphics. And I feel like there were panels about comic books. There was a guy who has illustrated a bunch of comics. And then, oddly enough, he's written a bunch of comics, but had somebody else draw them.
That's interesting.
And I wondered, why? Well, why wouldn't you just do both? But maybe just like the hat that you wear when you're an editor is different than the hat that you wear when you're a writer. Maybe the hat that you wear as an artist is different than the hat that you wear as a writer.
Yeah. I've just always been interested in writing a comic book, but I have no art talent whatsoever, but it'd be interesting to...
Well, what would you do then? Would you find somebody on DeviantArt or something like that and say, how would you like to collaborate on this? Or
yeah, I'd have to do something like that. Or I mean, pretty much what I've decided is, well, I can just write it as prose instead of as a comic book, but have it comic booky.
But you envisioned it as one medium.
Yeah. And
isn't it difficult for it to translate? Like I've written screenplays, and in the back of my mind, I thought, well, maybe I could turn that into a book or a short story or whatever and run it on my show. But I don't do it because it is a script it's a movie in my mind.
Because, you know, there's tons of comic book writers that don't draw. And so where did they learn that? How did they learn how to write a comic book if they didn't have the art with it or whatever? Anyway, I was just wondering if they had anything like that on there.
They probably do, and I didn't go to it. There are about 10 options for panels every single hour.
Wow.
And so every once in a while, there will be two or three that I want to go to. There was a panel about endings, the ending your novel. They said the hardest part, ending your novel. I thought, oh, I'm going to that. And I couldn't even get in the room. And can you guess why?
Dun, 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 dun.
And I was furious because he wasn't scheduled to be on that panel. But I guess somebody had mentioned that they were doing the endings panel earlier in the day or the day before. And he said, oh, hey, I'd like to go to that. And they said, okay, well, we'll pencil you in. And that enough meant that I couldn't get into the panel.
Yeah, that's a bummer.
And I was pretty furious there at the Alien.
It's kind of like when J.J. Abrams took everybody out for a concert from Hall H, and then Kevin Smith shows up and there's half the audience gone.
Yeah, I was able to get into Kevin Smith's panel so easily because all of them were at the, not Staples Center, what is the one there in San Diego, the baseball stadium? Petco Park, I think.
Okay.
And yeah, they were listening to a Star Wars concert for free.
That's funny.
Very, very briefly, something that I've talked to you about is that they were doing a contest, a writing contest for like a 1,000-word short story. And they announced it at the convention, at the conference. I always call it convention. They announced it at the conference. And then you have a month to send it in. And I mentioned it to you, and you seemed receptive, like, oh, hey, I could enter that.
Sure. 1,000 words?
Yeah, that's right. It's 1,000 words max. And 1,000 words is really, really short.
Yeah.
Do you agree?
I agree. I mean, it's more than 500 that escape artists do. But yeah, it's tough to get a whole idea across in a short amount of word count.
The theme of the contest is be careful what you wish for, which is a really all-encompassing, I mean, it's a Twilight Zone kind of thing.
It is.
You could probably make like a whole DVD set of be careful what you wish for Twilight Zone episodes, like Time Enough at Last, right?
Yeah.
And I thought, okay, well, I'll enter this for sure. And it sounded like you were interested in entering it.
Yeah.
And I mentioned it to Big Anklevich, and he's like, oh, yeah, I could do that. There's no chance that he will. I know Big Anklevich pretty well. But for 1,000 words, you could just sit down and pound one out in an hour or two. And the hard part is just, you know, coming up with that idea that is
right.
Good enough, but also short enough. You know,
yeah, what can you pack in there? Because you're not gonna be able to world build or explain anything, you're just gonna have to tell the story, and everybody has to get the gist of it.
Have you had any luck with that?
I haven't sat down and written, but I've been thinking about what should I do for a premise.
Well, you gave me some advice that I thought was pretty good. You said, because I was like, oh, I've gotten all these ideas in my mind, but I don't know what to do. You said, well, make a list of 5 ideas of be careful what you wish for, and then pick the one that you think is the best. And yeah, that's a really good suggestion. That day that I was just burnt out at the conference, I went to the library and I just sat down and I started writing one of these stories. And yeah, it ended up being like 1,200 words.
Oh.
Even though it seemed super basic to me, you know, there's no character development. There's hardly any dialogue, and it was still too long.
And then you have to try to cut it down and all that stuff.
Yeah. But it's impressive to me that you thought that you would do one too. And so maybe we should just mention this at the end of the episode.
Yeah.
And we can come back several months from now or weeks from now or whenever and talk about how it went, I suppose. The thing with contests is that you usually don't find out for months and months and months that you lost.
Right. They're offering some cash for it, though. So that's pretty cool. And it's not a journey into, you know, $15, $10, $5. They're putting out some cash for it. So that's enticing.
Well, yeah, I hope that you do write it and that you do send it in. Even if neither of us win, it's two new stories.
Yeah.
And it's something, if we wanted to, we could do an episode in the future where we present those stories. Or we could just do an episode where we talk about our stories. You know, Big Anklevich and I loved to do that Broken Mirror stuff.
Right.
And this is very much like that, where here is your premise. Although, be careful what you wish for is, it's not very narrow, is it?
No, it's pretty open-ended. You can go anywhere with that.
I instantly think of a horror story, right, with Be Careful What You Wish For, because it sounds like something a witch says or a fortune teller says, you know. But it could be fantasy. It could be sci-fi. You could write a Be Careful What You Wish For Western story. You could write a time travel story. You could write a very funny story. You could write the dirtiest YA story imaginable.
Or possibly the cleanest YA story.
Your stories tend to be pretty clean, right?
They do, in general, yeah.
Well, anyway, I guess I'll just leave that here at the end of the episode, and we can come back and tell people how it went. By the time this episode comes out, the contest is over, and so, you know, I don't have any qualms about talking about the, what do you call it, the rules of the contest or any of that.
Right. Yeah, we're not going to get anybody in on it as competition, so.
If I were faster, I guess, you know, we record this on a Wednesday and we put it out on Friday or Saturday, then yeah, somebody could say, hey, I loved that idea. So I wrote a story and I beat both of you. But I really like contests, and I like an opportunity to write something made to order that I wouldn't write otherwise. And so I always like it over on Journey Into when you do the story contests. I have written something for every one of your story contests, even though...
That's true. You have. You've been...
I didn't
faithful.
Send you the Journey Into Another Dimension via portal near a truck stop restroom. But I did write that for your contest. And so far, you line them up and I will knock them down.
There you go. Well, I'm definitely even more enticed to attend this writer's conference. So maybe we'll have to, if you can put up with me for Star Wars Celebration and you're willing to have me come with you to this conference, maybe we'll do that next year.
Well, yeah, that's something we haven't really talked about, but they just lifted like all of the mask mandate in Southern California. They lifted all the outdoor and then restricted the indoor thing. And then, and my guess is by the time Star Wars Celebration happens, we'll be able to just go like a regular convention. I mean, is that overly optimistic?
Well, it seems like it from what I'm hearing, but we can just cross our fingers and hope that all is well for that.
On this conference, they required everybody. This was unusual. I should have said this at the very beginning. Everybody had to wear masks except for the people on the panels. But not only that, everybody had to show either proof of vaccination or a negative COVID test in the last 48 hours. And I hadn't had to do that ever, except for working on like TV shows, you know, where they'd give you a COVID test and if you tested it. But I haven't had to show my card for anything. And so it was really weird. And the first couple of days, there were like empty seats that you were supposed to keep between you and strangers.
Oh.
And then by the last day, everybody was pushed up against one another as tight as can be. It's like, raise your hand if there's an empty seat next to you, because there were so many more people that wanted to show up on Saturday than the other days.
Headline, Brandon Sanderson causes super infection or whatever they call
it. Oh, super spreader event. Yeah.
Super spreader. Yeah.
I'll call him that from now on. Superman? How about super spreader Brandon Sanderson? But yeah, that's something you and I don't think we've talked about Star Wars Celebration this whole year.
We haven't.
I keep going to the website hoping that they'll have like a list of people that are going to come and stuff, and there's nothing.
Yeah, panels, events, all that kind of stuff.
Well, this isn't the Delusions of Grandeur podcast. I was going to say, well, we should talk about who we'd like to see there and what's likely. But there's all these shows, the Disney Plus shows or whatever. It's like there's no chance there's not going to be like a Bad Batch panel and a Cassian Andor panel and probably a Kenobi panel and a Ahsoka panel and Acolyte. Say that again?
Yeah, because Kenobi, the first episode will come out the day before Celebration starts. So,
well, so you and I will be the only people that haven't seen it.
Probably. So yeah, that's something to look forward to, or something I'm looking forward to. So
yeah, well, that's going to be here in no time at all. I was going to say we'll have plenty of time to talk about that, but will we? Well, hey man, I appreciate you hanging out with me for this long and indulging me on this. And the worst thing of all, the worst thing besides you getting no sleep at all, is that you have to pay for this episode to hear it. Just the most terrible thing. But yeah, keep looking for conferences and stuff in your area, because, you know, I know they hold them in Denver. I know they hold them in Salt Lake City and in Las Vegas. And it just seems like Boise is a big enough city that there should be something there.
Yeah. I guess maybe there's not enough local riders. I don't know. I thought about looking into that too, but that's just one more thing that I'll have to attend. But yeah, I'll keep looking, and hopefully something like that will come up.
Well, it seems like it would be fun to drive up and hang out and, you know, see your fine city.
Yeah.
But okay, well, thank you for joining me. Let the audience know if they, I mean, it's, chances are they know who you are from my show, but let them know how to find you.
So I hang out over at the Journey Into podcast, and you can go to the blog site, which is journeyintopodcast.blogspot.com. All the episodes are over there. If you want extra and early stuff, you can go to patreon.com/journeyinto and check out the stuff that I have there. Love to see you over there. But hey, you've got it pretty good over here on Rish's podcast too. So
they're breathing rarefied air, believe me.
Yeah, but thanks for inviting me for this episode. I appreciate it.
Well, you and I tend to get together a lot on podcasts, but I think I've only met you 3 times in real life.
That's true.
And so that is just a weird thing. It's like I talk to this guy. I text this guy like every other day, and I talk to him at least once a week. And yeah, I just... So, okay, thank you. Thank you for hanging out. I pity the fool that has to edit this episode.
Oh, me too.
But it has to be done. And journey on, man.
Journey on.
Ah, Creative Commons. 3.0 license. I barely knew thee. I remember how your hair would shine in the moonlight, how the hint of your smile would make my stomach start up a spin cycle, and how free you were. Free to listen to, download, and share. But you couldn't be tied down, couldn't be claimed as somebody's property, couldn't be charged for, couldn't be altered. I never knew what a good thing I had in you. Something so attributable. Something with no derivatives. Something to share and share alike. I never knew that good thing until it was done. Like this podcast.
Unless you're Brandon Sanderson. I almost called him Brian because I always say that to my son. I purposely get his name wrong, so he has to say, Dad, it's Brandon Sanderson. Don't you know anything?
Has your son ever expressed any of the things that I have expressed, though? Did he think Stormlight Archive was too long.
I think he likes it all. Of course, he for a time there, he was a voracious reader. You know, he read everything super fast, so it didn't matter how long it was to him. He just loved to read. He's backed off a little bit now. So I think he just ate it all up.
Okay. Well, I was hoping that you'd say, oh, yeah, he's commented a couple of times on those things, but oh, well.
Shoot, I had a couple other questions, but I don't know. Did you want to get to the contest?
What contest?
You found the writing contest and texted me about it.
Oh, we can. Yeah, that's fine. I'd completely forgotten.